From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Democrats have begun what one lawmaker calls the week from hell. Money to fund the government runs out at midnight on Thursday, and Democrats and Republicans in the Senate don't see eye to eye on how to prevent a complete shutdown of government services that millions of Americans rely on. On top of that, Democrats are scrambling to meet a self-imposed deadline this week to pass President Biden's plan for the largest expansion of the social safety net in decades. A vote on that is scheduled for today, and it has now been pushed back to Thursday because Democrats aren't on the same page. And joining us now to break this down is NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
First of all, what is at stake this week?
Well, I think the biggest, most pressing deadline for Congress is making sure that the government does not shut down at the end of the day on Thursday. Some of these deadlines that they're working with here are self-imposed in some ways, but when it comes to government funding, there's nothing they can do to move it. It's the end of the fiscal year, and if they do not pass something to extend funding, then the government will shut down. Now, there's also an underlying separate kind of deadline for this bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is that it contains part of a surface transportation bill that gets approved every year, and that money also runs out on Thursday. So it's something that they need to do, but it isn't quite as pressing as a government shutdown. Now, on top of all of that, there's still this separate debate about the President Biden's $3.5 trillion spending proposal and the future of that. Plus, there's the issue of the debt limit, which is looming over all of this as well.
There's so much here. Let's break this down. First of all, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had promised that lawmakers would vote today on this smaller infrastructure spending package. But then last night, as we know, she moved that vote to Thursday. Can you explain a little bit about why she pushed this back?
Well, partially it's because it has become politically tied to the bigger spending package. And that may be a little bit confusing, but it's a part of how Pelosi is trying to navigate the differences between moderates in her party and progressives in her party. Progressives wanted to vote on the broader reconciliation bill, the bill that includes much of Biden's agenda, at the same time or right around the same time as the bipartisan bill. They did that because they wanted to have buy-in from moderates. Because the thing we kind of talk about every time we talk about legislation lately is that there are very, very, very narrow margins for Democrats in both the House and the Senate. So they really need virtually every single Democrat in the House on board with either bill for it to move forward. So they become politically tied. She pushed back the vote from Monday to Thursday to give them more time to negotiate to ensure that a bill can pass.
Okay, on ABC News yesterday, Pelosi was asked if corporate tax increases would be in a final bill when it emerges. Now, she didn't answer that, but she signaled the price tag on this big spending bill and how it's negotiable. Let's listen.
Well, we'll see what we need. We'll see how the number comes down and what we need in that regard. But we have agreed on an array of pay-fors in the legislation.
How much do you think it could change?
That's a really good question and something that I'm watching really closely. Part of the reason that the number could change is because they're kind of trying to figure out how much they can raise out of tax increases and fees and other revenue changes, and then going back and kind of whittling down that original $3.5 trillion bill to fit the amount they can pay for. That is, in large part, a concession to moderates who said that they didn't want to vote for a spending package that wasn't paid for. They didn't want to vote on something that adds to the debt.
Right. Pelosi can only afford to lose a few Democrats in the House. In the Senate, Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer needs every vote to pass Build Back Better. Is the window closing for Democrats to get this done?
In some ways it is, because they're in a situation where they are kind of looking for a new way to pass the debt limit. And I know that we're now confusing two more deadlines, but part of what is happening here is they are using budget reconciliation, which is a tool to get around the filibuster in the Senate. They're using that to pass the Build Back Better plan. But they also need to get this debt limit bill passed that to prevent the government from defaulting on its credit. Doing that will be very difficult. And Republicans are saying the only way that it can get done right now is if Democrats attach it to the partisan bill. So it's one of these very difficult moments where lots of deadlines are lining up against each other. And it becomes very, very, very hard to make sure that everything gets done in the order it needs to get done.
Really quickly, I only have 15 seconds with you. What happens if there's a shutdown?
Well, they will have to continue negotiating to reopen government, but that means that things like parks will be closed and that the government will essentially not be functioning in large portions.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's not yet clear who will succeed Angela Merkel as she steps down as Chancellor of Germany, a post she's held for 16 years, leading Europe's largest democracy and biggest economy. Preliminary results from yesterday's election show the center-left Social Democrats narrowly beat Merkel's center-right Conservative Party, which had its worst ever showing in an election. But it was too close to call, meaning Germans must now form a coalition government, both top parties racing to convince smaller parties to join them and give them a mandate to govern. Reporter Esme Nicholson is in Berlin. And Esme, talk us through the SPD, again, the Social Democrats, yes, got the most votes, but that doesn't mean their leader, Olaf Scholz, will necessarily become chancellor.
That's right. And the Social Democrats, while they have come out on top by a couple of percentage points, and their leader, Olaf Scholz, has claimed victory and has told Merkel's conservatives, now led by Armin Laschet, to accept defeat. It's not as simple as that. And he's asking, but Scholz is asking Laschet to accept defeat because the conservatives under him have suffered their worst election result ever, which has been compounded by Merkel stepping down. The party lost a lot of Merkel voters, so to speak, to the SPD and the Greens. But again, it's not even as simple as Laschet accepting defeat. And in fact, he's refusing to do so. Both the SPD and the Conservatives only got around a quarter of the vote each, which historically is tiny for these big parties. And the election results actually show a highly fragmented electorate and now parliament. And this means that there's no clear winner and that it's going to take three parties to make up the majority needed to form a government. And of course, coalitions are nothing new in Germany, and politics is based on consensus building. But two-party governments are historically the norm here. And a reliance on three parties could make Germany politically less stable than it was under Merkel.
Well, you mentioned the Greens, and so let's just ask a quick question here. Whether climate change was a factor, there were huge protests over the weekend in Germany. Polls showed it was the number one concern going into the election. There was that terrible, deadly flooding in Germany recently. How did the Green Party do? How much was climate change a factor?
Well, the Green Party actually got historically their best result ever, coming in at around 15%. We don't have the very final results yet, but they were still disappointed with that result. I think they were expecting to get more simply because climate change was, as you say, at the top of the agenda for all parties. And we hear now all parties claiming to prioritise climate change. The Greens, of course, are saying that they are the party to be able to bring about that change and that they need to be involved in a coalition government in order to do so. So it certainly has played a big role, much bigger than it's ever played before.
Yeah, well, so meanwhile, there's going to be all this kind of backroom dealing and maneuvering to come up with a coalition government. What is the sense of what else was learned in the election? Angela Merkel did step down, but, she was both, held up by people for kind of taking a leadership position in the EU and filling a vacuum left by then President Trump and the US in a leadership position, but also criticized by many Germans for her policy welcoming migrants during some of the terrible migrant stories that you saw in that area. So what is this vote a reflection of? Is it a reflection on her or on other issues?
The general sense here is that it's not a reflection of her. It really is her party's chancellor candidate, Armin Laschet, who proved to be incredibly unpopular. And he's essentially being blamed for her party's poor result, mainly because he isn't Angela Merkel. I spoke to a lot of voters during the campaign who said that they'd only been CDU voters the past 16 years because of Merkel. I also met a lot of voters who aren't CDU voters and never have been, but greatly respect her. That said, there is a general acceptance that it's time for her to step down, not least from Merkel herself, who took the decision to do so. And although the SPD's Olaf Scholz ran a successful campaign by positioning himself as her natural successor, despite being from the rival party, he positioned himself as the candidate that stands for stability. There's also great appetite for change here, and not least from younger voters who voted for the Greens and the Free Democrats, who are going to be involved in coalition negotiations now. And while there's a lot of concern about fragmentation and whether three parties will be able to govern well together, it's actually important to point out that all of these parties are from the political centre. Germany's fringe parties, the far-right populist AfD and the post-communist far-left party Die Linke, both suffered losses in this election. And so the next German government will come from the political centre. It will be a government of three parties that still have a broad party political platform.
Reporter Esme Nicholson in Berlin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So many of our kids are struggling. The CDC says we're seeing more children than ever stressed out because of this pandemic, with spikes in suicide and depression. And now that in-person school is happening in most parts of the country, many school systems are trying to meet the overwhelming mental health needs of our students. Escondido High School in Southern California recently created a 1,600-square-foot wellness center. And so far, they tell us, more than 500 students have already sought help. Kim Bode is the school's social worker, and she joins us now with more on how we can help the students in our lives during this time. Kim, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Kim, we asked some of our young listeners to share the impact this whole period has had on them, and here's 10-year-old Millie O'Hara from Tempe, Arizona.
It's hard being stuck at home and not really seeing all my friends. They helped me a lot when I was in other grades, and they've helped me with stress and anxiety.
Kim, this is probably something that you've heard from a lot of your students. What are you seeing at your school?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt that the social isolation from the pandemic took a toll on our students' mental health and well-being. While many of our students are enjoying connecting with their peers again on campus, there are also many who are expressing heightened anxiety around socializing. They're also feeling academic pressure to recover the perceived learning loss from this last year. And importantly, many of our students and families are experiencing a great deal of stress around accessing basic needs and housing.
What are some of the ways that this anxiety and stress manifests itself? How are you seeing this in the students that you work with at the school?
Some are responding with psychosomatic concerns like stomach aches. Others are reporting sleep disturbance and perhaps high energy in the classroom. Then, though, there are others who are keeping very still and quiet and tend to isolate. We are having students self-refer to counseling services, and we're receiving many referrals from teachers and staff on campus.
The students are able to use this center throughout the day, and you're tackling some very challenging topics: suicide, eating disorder, family dynamics, as you said, losses within their families. I think that oftentimes we're talking about COVID-19 as an adult problem, but children are part of families, and that loss is very real.
Yes.
What are some of your approaches to handling some of these difficult topics?
Yes, well, our social workers are trained to assess and respond to student needs with a trauma-informed lens. They are triaging with our school-based teams, counselors, and administrators to determine the most appropriate intervention for the student, and then working closely with the family to help connect them to those support services. And so our intention for the Wellness Center is to provide as many programs, workshops to get student voice and student empowerment involved in the process.
You know, I'm thinking about something that kids are not always going to go to adults when they're struggling. You mentioned 500 students have already accessed the Wellness Center. but there are thousands more who are in the school who may not be going to the center. As a teacher, what are some of the warning signs that you look for? And really beyond the classroom, what should caregivers be looking for?
I would suggest that we be extra mindful and aware of any abrupt changes in student attendance and engagement, peer relationships, or interest in previously enjoyed activities and events. So we want to take all of these expressions very seriously and do our very best to create support services and around the student.
And is it really safe to say, Kim, that we should be checking in with all of our young people? Because if you've been at home for the last 17 months and then you're starting school, you're going from the slow lane to the fast lane. I mean, even just with that being the reality, there's a lot that kids are dealing with. And these consequences of not treating some of the anxiety around this, I mean, this can interfere with the actual learning in the classroom.
I cannot agree with you more. I do believe that this is the year to offer grace and compassion to ourselves, to our teachers, and to our kids. I know that this is a major adjustment for our students. I mean, even just to be sitting in the classroom, everything is an adjustment right now.
Yep. You know, I'm thinking about schools throughout the country who will be listening to this, and they don't have the capacity to have a wellness center that's over 1,000 square feet. That sounds amazing. What would you recommend schools be thinking about when it comes to dealing with students' well-being and their mental health? What is the school's role?
I think the more that we're creating spaces for the students to come together and to talk, and they are openly expressing more emotions and thoughts than I remember in the past, like they're asking for help and wanting to talk. So I believe that if our schools can just create that environment and have them take part in feeling like they are part of the movement towards recovering from such a challenging year, and to also proactively provide curriculum to prevent behaviors that we don't want to see from our students.
And before I let you go, I want to also ask you, you know, I think as adults, we hear that more kids talking about their mental health and anxiety and thoughts of suicide. It feels alarming. It's like, oh, something is wrong. But it actually is also a positive sign that they're talking to us, right?
I definitely agree. And I believe that this just may be the silver lining of the pandemic, that students and adults are more openly talking about how they're feeling, how they manage stress, how they cope, and what's most important to them.
Kim Bode is a social worker at Escondido High School in Southern California. Kim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for covering this topic.
Well, the children's magazine Highlights has seen firsthand how this pandemic is impacting our children. They receive up to 2,600 letters a month from children all over the world. And for the last 75 years, they've responded to every single one of them. These days, about half of the letters are about COVID. But the things children are worried about are somewhat different than us adults. Not a single kid, according to Highlights, has written about the pain of wearing a mask to school every day. But they do write about things like feeling alone, missing their friends, and worrying about their parents. We thought it would be neat to hear some of those letters. Here's Highlights for Children editor-in-chief Christine Culley reading some of their young readers' letters.
The top three concerns kids have written to us about during the pandemic are probably boredom and disappointments, school, and worry about the health of others. Kids wrote to us to express concern about the health of their friends and family, to express concern about healthcare workers and other frontline heroes. We took a lot of inspiration from the letters we received from kids. This is a letter we received from a child who was very much caught in the situation of wanting to do the right thing and wanting to be around people who may not be doing what was considered to be the right thing. Dear Highlights, I am 8 years old and I hope you can help. I have been friends with my neighbors Ava and Sarah since forever and just recently became best friends with my neighbors Summer and Robin. Because of COVID, we have to be safe because my mom has a brain tumor. However, Summer and Robin's family is also being safe, so we think it's okay to play like normal outside. I've also been playing with Ava and Sarah, social distancing outside for the last week. Now Summer and Robin's parents won't let me play with Ava and Sarah. I want to play with both of them the same amount. Any advice? We respond to a letter like that by first making sure kids know they were heard. And then we validate their feelings and we let them know that what they're going through is normal, that their experience is shared by a lot of people right now. And then we always encourage kids, no matter what they write about, we always encourage them to find a trusted adult they can talk to in real time. The second letter I want to read is from a seventh grader. And she wrote, "Dear Highlights, because of COVID, I feel like my life is constantly changing. Adding to that, I moved for the first time last summer and I'm going into seventh grade this fall. I just want everything to stay the same." I think very often we grown-ups think that kids expect us to have all the answers in uncertain times. And what we've learned over the years is that kids really don't expect us to have all the answers. Mostly they want to be heard, they want to have their feelings validated, and they want a little guidance and support. If we lean in and listen to kids, we inevitably learn something that helps us serve kids better. They want more connection, they crave more meaningful moments with their parents and the other adults they love.
That was Editor-in-Chief Christine Culley reading a few of the thousands of letters they've received from children over this pandemic. Highlights recently published a book of those letters from the last 8 decades, and you can learn more about it on our website, hereandnow.org. Britain is dealing with a massive fuel shortage, and the government is struggling to respond. UK Transport Minister Grant Shapps blames panic buying. Here he is yesterday on the BBC.
But as soon as you say to people, there's a shortage, people tend to react, and it's not required. There's plenty of petrol in the country.
But government assurances have not stopped people from rushing to the pump. And let's bring in NPR London correspondent Frank Lakefoot for more. And Frank, I understand you're joining us from a gas station right now.
Well, actually, I just got back. We were driving. I just pulled into my house, but we were driving up looking for gas, actually for diesel. And we finally found the one place. I was actually riding around on my bike earlier. I couldn't find anything open. We found one gas station that was open. It didn't have any diesel. So we just came back. We weren't able to get any.
Wow. There's been a shortage of gas tanker drivers in the country, right? I mean,
exactly.
But that didn't translate into problems at the pump until this past weekend. What happened exactly?
Yeah, what happened was last week there was apparently there was a leak from a government meeting in which BP said that they were down, maybe had 2/3 of the normal amount they would normally have gas in their stations here in the United Kingdom. And people began to get very anxious. And there was there has been trouble with tanker drivers and all kinds of drivers. So people began to line up and people began to get very, very nervous. And you found panic buying. So suddenly, I would say, you know, beginning of Wednesday and certainly Friday, Saturday night, we saw long lines in front of gas stations.
What are some of the ways that the British government is trying to solve this problem?
Well, it can't solve it immediately because they simply don't have enough drivers. And so what they're going to do is they agreed to issue thousands, about 5,000 emergency work visas to get truck drivers into the country. But that's going to take a while. And so I think what they have to hope for is they can just continue to get tanker trucks to these gas stations and for people to calm down. Now, people are running out of gas. I mean, my car is down on red. So I actually, when I was up at this station not so long ago, just 20, 30 minutes ago, I asked them, are you going to get diesel overnight? They said, yes. So I'm driving up there first thing in the morning, but hopefully people won't top up. They'll just, you know, get as much as they need. And hopefully maybe by mid or late week, things will calm down a little bit. But certainly it's been pretty shocking. If you drive all over London, I was talking to a bunch of drivers who were up at this gas station, and they said everywhere they were driving and also where I was riding my bicycle, I saw almost no gas stations open.
Hmm. Before I let you go, I have just under a minute with you. I mean, does it look like folks are blaming Prime Minister Boris Johnson for this shortage? Of course, we can trace this back to Brexit, as you mentioned, with these hiring of foreign workers and not being able to deliver gasoline as easily.
Brexit is definitely a factor in the sense that there are thousands of people went home to Europe after Brexit, the drivers. But it's also a very complicated situation. There was a lot of early retirements and things like that. Right now, the opposition Labour Party is meeting. They're having their annual meeting, and they're, of course, blaming Boris Johnson. How much people will blame him, I don't know. It'll really depend on how long it goes on for, Tanya.
That's NPR London correspondent Frank Langfitt. Thank you so much for this update, and I hope you're going to be able to fill your car really soon.
Thanks. I'll try in the morning.
And let's take a minute now to consider Katharine Graham, as an exhibit at the New York Historical Society is currently doing. If you're saying, who's Katharine Graham? Well, that's the question that launched the exhibit. It was posed by a white person serving female leaders at the Historical Society who realized the story of the woman once called the most powerful in America was being lost. Warren Buffett said that Katharine Graham, as publisher of the Washington Post, saved the country by publishing the Pentagon Papers that revealed lies about the Vietnam War and encouraging and printing the Watergate investigation. She wasn't always so bold. Here's a description of a young Kay Graham, or Katherine Meyer, her maiden name.
Profoundly shy, profoundly insecure, she was raised as a privileged young woman of her time would be to be an ornament to society, to marry well, to have beautiful children, to engage in genteel good works.
That's Jean Gutierrez, curator of the exhibit, cover story Katharine Graham, CEO. She's speaking at a recent CitySpace event at member station WBUR here in Boston. We started at the beginning. Katharine Meyer's mother was a rare female journalist, her father a wealthy banker and consultant to presidents who bought the Washington Post in 1933.
And her father, until she got bit by the journalism bug, was not really a big presence in her life. It was journalism that really brought them together.
Well, he got her a job.
He did, yes. So after her graduation, she went out to San Francisco and started covering labor unrest along the docks. She was a very passionate advocate of the labor movement at that time.
This was not at the Washington Post, but then he did get her a job at the Washington Post. Have I got this right? And famously said, well, if it doesn't work, we'll get rid of her.
Yes.
His own daughter.
So a nice vote of support there. Yeah. But yes, she did start at the Washington Post as a copy boy and a messenger in the women's pages.
They were called the women's pages.
They were called the women's pages. And I believe the next slide reflects that.
Okay. We were looking at slides from the exhibit. There's Katharine conferring with reporters Woodward and Bernstein. There are the dresses she wore to famous balls. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. And by the way, she ultimately, as publisher, changed those women's pages to the style section. But in the beginning, the men made the decisions.
Only a few months after starting at the Washington Post, Katharine Graham met a brilliant but rather volatile young lawyer named Philip Graham. He didn't show a lot of interest in journalism. They had sort of a whirlwind courtship. And when they did marry, he started off their marriage by insisting that he wouldn't touch the horrible hunk of money that his in-laws had. And she was fine with that. She went along with it. But by 1948, control of the Washington Post had passed from the Meyers, Eugene and Agnes, to the Grahams, Phil and Katharine. And he had roughly three times the number of shares that she had, courtesy of her parents. It was really a gift from them to him because, as Eugene Meyer said, and Katharine Graham wrote that she agreed at the time, that no man should be put in the position of working for his wife.
Well, and her father made him the publisher, not her.
Not her.
Even though she had studied journalism.
Yes.
So she became a self-described doormat. She completely dropped her journalism and her aspirations, and a devoted wife. Mm-hmm. There is a sad ending to that story. Okay. He killed himself.
Yeah.
She ascends to the job. It's viewed with complete skepticism.
Very much so.
So that brings us to this moment.
Exactly.
Up on the screen pops a picture of Katharine Graham in a dazzling mask and gown on the arm of a tuxedo Truman Capote. It's the famed mid-60s black and white ball. The black and white ball, what happened?
Well, at that point, Katharine Graham had been at the helm of the Post for about 3 years. She had already discovered the aspects of the job that were the most fraught for her. Firing people and hiring people remained highly gendered and very difficult for her throughout her career because she was always portrayed as this very difficult, tyrannical, whimsical woman, and whoever lost their job was the victim of her feminine whims. She had already dealt with the election of 1964, where Lyndon Johnson gave her extraordinary access to his campaign, hoping that her personal support would translate into an official endorsement from the Post. But she wrote that she'd inherited a policy of non-endorsement and she didn't have quite the gumption to do any independent thinking yet. But come 1966, Truman Capote, who's, you know, riding this wild whirlwind of celebrity and bestsellerdom with the publication of In Cold Blood, calls up Katharine Graham and he says, "Honey, I've just decided you're depressed and need cheering up, so I'm going to give you a party." And she's on the end of the phone saying, "What are you talking about?"
It was the party of the century.
It was the party of the century, as Gloria Steinem said, as she wrote about in Vogue, because what it really translated to was an opportunity for Katharine Graham to emerge onto the national stage with Hollywood, with the fashion people, with the literati, with the New York intellectuals, with society, with European aristocrats, all of whom Truman Capote drew together and put her in the center of it. This party was hyped for months. But then she also is able to take that principle behind the black and white ball and make it her own. And so her parties afterwards became very legendary for bringing together all these very different but very interesting people. George Shultz, the former Secretary of State, talked about how much that impacted her influence in Washington because she became a convener of people who had interesting things to say.
Well, and it seemed to help her find the backbone that she always had, it would seem. It's a backbone Katharine Graham would need. Here I'm going to heavily synopsize our conversation with Jean Gutierrez, curator of the Katharine Graham exhibit at the New York Historical Society, because we wandered off into some wild territory, including how when Daniel Ellsberg revealed he had the Pentagon Papers, which revealed the lies about the Vietnam War, it was in a press conference on the porch that would later be my home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, anyway, the New York Times printed some of the damning documents, but the Nixon administration sued, the case went to the Supreme Court. Then Katharine Graham ordered her paper, The Washington Post, to print all of the Pentagon Papers. The Nixon administration issued an injunction. She also greenlit the expose reported by Woodward and Bernstein about how President Nixon ordered his minions to break into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's therapist in the Watergate complex to undermine his credibility. Well, the court ultimately ruled against an injunction. Nixon would later step down. But for 15 days in America, a free press was told it couldn't be free, and Katharine Graham defied that.
And there was a profound financial risk because in 1971, they were preparing for their first public stock offering. So if she had, or if anyone at the Post had been hit with a criminal charge, well, that throws a giant monkey wrench into your public stock offering. And the Post at this point was growing beyond a small family paper into a larger media corporation with radio stations, with television stations. Well, you can't hold a radio license or a television license if you have a felony conviction. Those very lucrative properties would be stripped from the Washington Post. And that was a threat that the Nixon administration dangled when then Attorney General John Ashcroft made his infamous threat that Katie Graham's going to get her tit caught in a big fat ringer.
Yes, he said that.
He really did.
So this is the most powerful woman in America after those decisions. You show all those dresses. Did you ever hesitate? Dresses. When she also
took down a president.
Exactly. Well, part of what we do at the Center for Women's History is we try to tell an unexpected story. And part of the story with women's power is a lot of the avenues that women use to access power are discounted because they're not necessarily the same ones that men use. You know, the power of sociability, you know, the power of bringing people together, the power of hospitality, the power of fashion, you know, the message that you send with your clothes. After the Black and White Ball, Katharine Graham became fairly irregular in the fashion press. And so that kind of thing, you know, that's not the kind of power that you think of when you think of a newspaper owner, of someone who's really got their fingers on the pulse of what's going on in American politics and business and journalism. But that doesn't mean it's not real.
It is powerful.
Yes.
Yeah. That's Jean Gutierrez, curator of the exhibit Cover Story, Katharine Graham, CEO, at the New York Historical Society. And by the way, in 1976, Graham also faced a bruising labor dispute with typesetters who hung her in effigy and walked on a contract offer. She replaced them with Black, Vietnamese, and female workers who previously couldn't get into the all-white, all-male union. She saw it as a failure, others a shining moment. Katharine Graham died in 2001 at 84.
It may be hard to remember now, but there was a time when we were poised to become the country with the highest vaccination rate in the world. Just last April, the U.S. was hitting new vaccination records each day and outpacing nearly every country. Now, nearly 6 months later, vaccination rates are stagnant, and according to the Financial Times, the U.S. now ranks 37th in the world. So what exactly happened? Derek Thompson, a staff writer with The Atlantic, looked into this question, and he joins us now with more. Welcome back, Derek.
Good to be here. Thank you.
How did we get here? What makes Americans less likely to get vaccinated than other people from other countries?
Well, first, let's go through some explanations that I thought were true a couple months ago, but that I no longer think are true. So we have been flatlining, or at least accelerating in our vaccination effort, since about April, when I got my second Moderna shot. And in the spring, I thought the reasons had a lot to do with our public health communications. I said, you know, maybe it's because of the FDA's mixed messaging around the side effects of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Or maybe it's because of the fact that I think some public health officials have in their public communications downplayed the effectiveness of the vaccines. But I spoke with a researcher in Denmark who told me that other countries around the world have dealt with these exact same hiccups. They have also had vaccines like AstraZeneca that had some vaccine pauses. They have also been extremely forthright with their public about who should and shouldn't necessarily take the vaccine given their risks or given their fears of, right, of some of the side effects. And so it got me thinking about other reasons. And I think there are three that we should talk about. I think the U.S. is unusually uninsured, unusually contrarian, and unusually polarized politically compared to the rest of the developed world.
Okay, let's break these down, these three: uninsured, contrarian, and polarized. Taking up uninsured, that's interesting, because the vaccination is free. So how is that preventing people from getting vaccinated?
Well, many people don't know that the vaccine is free. That's a really important thing. And polling from the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has really done some gold standard polling when it comes to attitudes toward the vaccine, have found that no group in America is more likely to say they will not get this vaccine than young Americans without insurance. That is the most likely group to say we're just not going to get this. I think that has a lot to do with fear of side effects and the fact that this is a group that doesn't have regular contact with the physician, so they aren't getting counsel from their doctors, but they also don't feel that there's a doctor they can go to in case something goes wrong. And so in that case, I think they're sort of weighing the confidence they have with their own natural immune system against their fear about a new vaccine and deciding to not get the shot. Of course, I think they should get the shot, but that is my read of the rationalization for why this group is so unlikely to accept the vaccines.
Also, what is so unique about the U.S.'s brand of polarization?
Yeah, I think it's really unique that not only do we have extremely high political polarization, but also we only have two major parties. And one of those parties, the Republican Party, has absolutely taken up vaccine resistance as a prominent cause within its media. So yes, it's totally true that there's some GOP governors and even President Donald Trump who have either admitted to being vaccinated or also recommended taking the shots. But it's important to point out that I think the party's media organs, including primetime Fox News, have pretty consistently questioned the benefits of the vaccines, amplified the side effects, and blasted attempts to promote widespread vaccinations. And I think that the fact that you have large polarization within a two-party system means that there is a lot of media energy behind the anti-vax movement.
Yeah. Can you also break down this idea of us being unusually contrarian? I mean, throughout our history, Americans really emphasize these values of independence and freedom. Is that culture playing into this as well?
Yeah, I really do think that it is. You know, this is a harder thing to quantify because it's culture, and culture is difficult to summarize in raw numbers. But I think it's possible that a country whose laws and culture celebrates independence of thought might naturally yield a large crop of two very different groups. On the one hand, a lot of paradigm-breaking entrepreneurs and scientists who look at the history of tradition and say, we can do better. They have this improving mentality. And on the other hand, that same culture of independence of thought might yield a lot of conspiratorial, crankish thinking. On the other hand, people who feel like they can, quote, do their own research when it comes to the vaccines while ignoring where the research actually lives, like the CDC or NIH. And so I think that what you see here is that it's both ironic and maybe all too fitting that America did more than any country to invent, produce, and distribute the mRNA vaccines, and yet we also seem to have the world's largest group of contrarians in the developed world who think that those same mRNA vaccines are no good.
You know what, Derek? Our next conversation has to be about how we can actually turn this ship around, how officials can help solve this problem. Unfortunately, we don't have the time today.
Next
week. But Derek,
week.
Thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.